Introduction, 1990. It was well after midnight. Elton Manzioni, his wife Lynn, and I sat at their kitchen table, drinking steaming cups of coffee. Rock and roll music throbbed from the living room. A lean, dark man with large Mediterranean features, Elton was chain-smoking Pall Malls and telling me about his experiences as a 20-year-old U.S. Navy SEAL in Vietnam in 1964. It was hot and humid that sultry Georgia night, and we were exhausted, but I pressed him for more specific information. "What was your most memorable experience?" I asked. Elton looked down and with considerable effort said quietly, "There's one experience I remember very well. It was my last assignment. I remember my last assignment very well." "They," Elton began, referring to the Navy commander and Special Forces colonel who issued orders to the SEAL team, called the three of us, Elton, Eddie Sweats, and John Laboon, into the briefing room and sat us down. "They said they were having a problem at a tiny village about a quarter of a mile from North Vietnam in the DMZ. They said some choppers and recon planes were taking fire from there. They never really explained why, for example, they just didn't bomb it, which was their usual response, but I got the idea that the village chief was politically connected and that the thing had to be done quietly. We worked in what were called hunter-killer teams," Elton explained. "The hunter team was a four-man unit, usually all Americans, sometimes one or two Vietnamese or Chinese mercenaries called counter-terrorists, CTs for short. Most CTs were enemy soldiers who had deserted, or South Vietnamese criminals. Our job was to find the enemy and nail him in place, spot his position, then go back to a prearranged place and call in the killer team. The killer team was usually 12 to 25 South Vietnamese special forces led by Green Berets. Then we join up with the killer team and take out the enemy. But in this particular mission," Elton explained, "the SEALs went in alone. They said that there was this 51 caliber anti-aircraft gun somewhere near the village that was taking pot shots at us, and that there was a specific person in the village operating the gun. They give us a picture of the guy and a map of the village. It's a small village, maybe 12 to 15 hooches. This is the hooch, they say. The guy sleeps on the mat on the left side. He has two daughters. They don't know if he has a mama-san or where she is, but they say, you guys are going to go in and get this guy. You," meaning me, "are going to snuff him. Sweats is going to find out where the gun is and blow it. Laboon is going to hang back at the village gate covering us. He's the stoner, he's got the machine gun. And I'm going to go into the hooch and snuff this guy. What you need to do first, they say, is sit alongside the trail leading from the village to the gun for a day or two and watch where this guy goes, and that will help us uncover the gun." Which it did. We watched him go right to where the gun was. We were 30 yards away and we watched for a while. When we weren't watching, we'd take a break and go another 600 yards down the trail to relax. And we did that for maybe 2 days, watched him coming and going, and got an idea of his routine. When he went to bed, when he got up, where he went, did he go behind the hooch to piss, did he go into the jungle, that sort of thing. They told us, do that, then come back and tell us what you found out. So we went back and said, we know where the gun is, and we showed them where it was on the map. We were back in camp for about 6 hours, and they said, okay, you're going to go out at 0400 tomorrow, and it's like we say, you, meaning me, are going to snuff the guy, Sweats is going to take out the gun, and Laboon's going to cover the gate. Elton explained that on special missions like this, the usual procedure was to snatch the targeted VC cadre and bring him back to Dong Ha for interrogation. In that case, Elton would have slipped into the hooch and rendered the cadre unconscious while Sweats demolished the anti-aircraft gun, and Laboon signaled the killer team to descend upon the village in its black CIA-supplied helicopters. The SEALs and their prisoner would then climb on board and be extracted. In this case, however, the cadre was targeted for assassination. We left out of Cam Lo, Elton continued. We were taken by boat partway up the river and walked in by foot. Maybe 2.5-3 miles. At 4 in the morning, we started moving across an area that was maybe 100 yards wide. It's a clearing running up to the village. We're wearing black pajamas, and we've got black paint on our faces. We're doing this very carefully, moving on the ground 1/4 inch at a time. Move, stop, listen. Move, stop, listen. To check for tripwires, you take a blade of grass and put it between your teeth. Move your head up and down, from side to side, watching the end of the blade of grass. If it bends, you know you've hit something. But of course, the grass never sets off the tripwire, so it's safe. It takes us an hour and a half to cross this relatively short stretch of open grass because we're moving so slowly. And we're being so quiet we can hardly hear each other, let alone anybody else hearing us. I mean, I know they're out there. Laboon's 5 yards that way, Sweats is 5 yards to my right, but I can't hear them. And so we crawl up to the gate. There's no booby traps. I go in. Sweats has a satchel charge for the 51 caliber gun and is split off to where it is, maybe 60 yards away. Laboon is sitting at the gate. The village is very quiet. There are some dogs. They're sleeping. They stir, but they don't even growl. I go into the hooch and I spot my person. Well, somebody stirs in the next bed. I'm carrying my commando knife, and one of the things we learned is how to kill somebody instantly with it. So I put my hand over her mouth and come up under the second rib, go through the heart, give it a flick, it snaps the spinal cord. Not thinking. Because I think, hey. Then I hear the explosion go off and I know the gun is out. Somebody else in the corner starts to stir. So I pull out the sidearm and put it against her head and shoot her. She's dead. Of course, by this time, the whole village is awake. I go out, waiting for Sweats to come, because the gun's been blown. People are kind of wandering around, and I'm pretty dazed. And I look back into the hooch, and there were two young girls. I'd killed the wrong people. Elton Manzioni and his comrades return to their base at Camlo. Strung out from dexedrine and remorse, Elton went into the ammo dump and sat on top of a stack of ammunition crates with a grenade, its pin pulled, between his legs, and an M16 cradled in his arms. He sat there refusing to budge until he was given a ticket home. In early 1984, Elton Manzioni was the first person to answer a query I had placed in a Vietnam veterans newsletter asking for interviews with people who had served in the Phoenix program. Elton wrote to me saying, "While I was not a participant in Phoenix, I was closely involved in what I think was the forerunner. It was part of what was known as Op Plan 34. This was the old Leaping Lena infiltration program for LRRP, Long Range Reconnaissance Patrol, operations into Laos. During the time I was involved, it became the well-known Delta program. While all this happened before Phoenix, the operations were essentially the same. Our primary function was intelligence gathering, but we also carried out the undermining of the infrastructure types of things, such as kidnapping, assassination, sabotage, etc." "The story needs to be told," Elton said, "because the whole aura of the Vietnam War was influenced by what went on in the hunter-killer teams of Phoenix, Delta, etc. That was the point at which many of us realized we were no longer the good guys in the white hats defending freedom, that we were assassins, pure and simple. That disillusionment carried over to all other aspects of the war and was eventually responsible for it becoming America's most unpopular war." The story of Phoenix is not easily told. Many of the participants, having signed non-disclosure statements, are legally prohibited from telling what they know. Others are silenced by their own consciences. Still others are professional soldiers whose careers would suffer if they were to reveal the secrets of their employers. Falsification of records makes the story even harder to prove. For example, there is no record of Elton Manzioni's ever having been in Vietnam. Yet for reasons which are explained in my first book, The Hotel Tacloban, I was predisposed to believe Manzioni. I had confirmed that my father's military records were deliberately altered to show that he had not been imprisoned for 2 years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp in World War II. The effects of the cover-up were devastating and ultimately caused my father to have a heart attack at the age of 45. Thus, long before I met Elton Manzioni, I knew the government was capable of concealing its misdeeds under a cloak of secrecy, threats, and fraud, and I knew how terrible the consequences could be. Then I began to wonder if cover-ups like the one concerning my father had also occurred in the Vietnam War, and that led me, in the fall of 1983, to visit David Houle, Director of Veteran Services in New Hampshire. I asked David Houle if there was a part of the Vietnam War that had been concealed, and without hesitation he replied, "Phoenix." After explaining a little about it, he mentioned that one of his clients had been in the program, then added that his client's service records, like those of Elton Manzioni's and my father's, had been altered. They showed that he had been a cook in Vietnam. I asked to meet Houle's client, but the fellow refused. Formerly with special forces in Vietnam, he was disabled and afraid the Veterans Administration would cut off his benefits if he talked to me. That fear of the government, so incongruous on the part of a war veteran, made me more determined than ever to uncover the truth about Phoenix, a goal which has taken 4 years to accomplish. That's a long time to spend researching and writing a book, but I believe it was worthwhile, for Phoenix symbolizes an aspect of the Vietnam War that changed forever the way Americans think about themselves and their government. Developed in 1967 by the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, Phoenix combined existing counterinsurgency programs in a concerted effort to neutralize the Viet Cong infrastructure, VCI. The euphemism neutralize means to kill, capture, or make to defect. The word infrastructure refers to those civilians suspected of supporting North Vietnamese and Viet Cong soldiers, like the one targeted in Elton Manzioni's final operation. Central to Phoenix is the fact that it targeted civilians, not soldiers. As a result, its detractors charge that Phoenix violated that part of the Geneva Conventions guaranteeing protection to civilians in time of war. By analogy, said Ogden Reed, a member of a congressional committee investigating Phoenix in 1971, if the Union had had a Phoenix program during the Civil War, its targets would have been civilians like Jefferson Davis or the mayor of Macon, Georgia. Under Phoenix, or Phung Hoang, as it was called by the Vietnamese, due process was totally non-existent. South Vietnamese civilians whose names appeared on blacklists could be kidnapped, tortured, detained for 2 years without trial, or even murdered, simply on the word of an anonymous informer. At its height, Phoenix managers imposed quotas of 1,800 neutralizations per month on the people running the program in the field, opening up the program to abuses by corrupt security officers, policemen, politicians, and racketeers, all of whom extorted innocent civilians as well as VCI. Legendary CIA officer Lucian Conine described Phoenix as a very good blackmail scheme for the central government. If you don't do what I want, you're VC. Because Phoenix neutralizations were often conducted at midnight while its victims were home sleeping in bed, Phoenix proponents described the program as a scalpel designed to replace the bludgeon of search-and-destroy operations, airstrikes, and artillery barrages that indiscriminately wiped out entire villages and did little to win the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese population. Yet, as Elton Manzioni's story illustrates, the scalpel cut deeper than the U.S. government admits. Indeed, Phoenix was, among other things, an instrument of counterterror, the psychological warfare tactic in which VCI members were brutally murdered, along with their families or neighbors, as a means of terrorizing the neighboring population into a state of submission. Such horrendous acts were, for propaganda purposes, often made to look as if they had been committed by the enemy. This book questions how Americans, who consider themselves a nation ruled by laws and an ethic of fair play, could create a program like Phoenix. By scrutinizing the program and the people who participated in it, and by employing the program as a symbol of the dark side of the human psyche, the author hopes to articulate the subtle ways in which the Vietnam War changed how Americans think about themselves. This book is about terror and its role in political warfare. It will show how, as successive American governments sink deeper and deeper into the vortex of covert operations, ostensibly to combat terrorism and communist insurgencies, the American people gradually lose touch with the democratic ideals that once defined their national self-concept. This book asks what happens when Phoenix comes home to roost.